Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 36 of The Grumpy Strategist. And we're doing something different this episode. I have the helm. Michael is not here. I'm Marcus Hellier, head of research at Strategic Analysis Australia. I've kidnapped the show for one episode, and I have as a special guest star the third amigo from Strategic Analysis Australia, Peter Jennings, founder and director of Strategic Analysis Australia. Welcome, Peter.
Marcus, it's great to be here in the Grumpy Grotto. I've finally made it. How many? 36 episodes in, and at last I'm here to speak with your audience.
Yes, you've been great. Invited into the bunker deep in the bowels of the Brindabellas.
I'd like what you've done with the place too.
I think it's really quite nice. Yeah. Just don't tell anybody where it is.
Won't do that.
Okay. So, Peter, you have a very, very deep background in Australian security and defence, former advisor to multiple defence ministers, former deputy secretary of strategy in the Department of Defence, two-time executive director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And I think for many people, you were the face of ASPI. You weren't the eminence grise, the hidden guy behind the curtain pulling the strings. You were out there, you know, engaging with the Australian public.
A great face for radio, as my wife says, Marcus. So
That's my line. You're not allowed to steal it.
You're being very kind.
And now you've set up with Michael his new think tank, Strategic Analysis Australia. And we were invited by the Institute for Public Affairs to write a series of essays outlining for the general audience Australia's strategic circumstances and the pressing need to do something about it, and to present recommendations to the next government, whoever that may be, on what we can do to address our worsening strategic circumstances. The IPA has now brought those six essays together in one, I would say, very handsome volume called No Higher Priority, A Blueprint for Immediate Action on Australia's Defence 2025 to 2028. And essentially all three of us contributed to that in various ways. And each of those six chapters has six recommendations, and we can get to the recommendations in a sense. So, but I think with that intro outlining your background in this area, you're well placed to sort of make some historical comparison. So the first question is, how are our strategic circumstances today?
So the first thing I'm going to do is agree with you that I think the book No Higher Priority is actually a very handsome volume that IPA and Australian Scholarly Publishing have put together. Do you know it's actually available right now at Amazon.com, Marcus?
And yes, we will have a link. We'll get the tech guy to put in a link where readers can click on it and order it. You can order it in hard copy or in electronic copy.
The tech guy should definitely do that because it's actually number one best-selling in Amazon's defence policy niche, which I must admit is a fairly niche category.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of people competing for that title, but it's nice to be number one, I have to say.
It sure is nice to be number one.
I can add best-selling author to my resume now.
So, but let's get to the question. So the state of Australia's strategic outlook. Frankly, I think anyone that spends any time in the defence and security space will know that successive ministers and prime ministers, really from Scott Morrison's mid-year of 2020 strategic update, have been saying that, you know, these are the most challenging strategic circumstances that Australia has faced since the end of the war.
We keep hearing that
dozens and dozens of times. And, you know, you might think on the basis of that, Marcus, that it would lead governments to do things differently in terms of defence planning and defence spending. And I guess we'll get to that in a minute. But is the statement true? Broadly, yes, I think it is. And the main reason for that concern, not the only reason, but the main reason, has been the growth of a more assertive People's Republic of China and the development of very significant military capabilities inside the People's Liberation Army.
Which we have seen very close to Australia very recently.
And the circumnavigation of that little flotilla of Chinese vessels, including one of their most sophisticated cruisers, I think is really a demonstration for the world to see that China has reached a level of sophistication and a level of reach with their military forces that really does change the strategic outlook. And then you have to combine those capability issues with clearly a more assertive China under Xi Jinping, right? He's been General Secretary of the Communist Party since 2012 and is aggressively pursuing what he terms the China dream, which is really the, as Xi would put it, the return of China to a sort of central leading role in global security, married to a view that Xi has articulated since 2012, which is that the West is in decline. It's inevitable that sort of Marxist structural, the Marxist analysis of structural flaws inside capitalism means that the West is on inevitable decline. There is no reversing it. China is going to become the world's global power. And it's seeking to give effect to that around the world by building exclusive strategic relationships with the Pacific Islands, by treating Southeast Asia as a sort of a mini Chinese lake that it should dominate. Everywhere from the Arctic to Antarctic, there's a Chinese presence working to sort of cement China's global leadership role.
And why is that a bad thing? I mean, there are senior Australian politicians or former senior Australian politicians who seem to suggest, well, we just shouldn't worry about that. That's all fair enough.
Yeah, I think that's a dangerously short-sighted perspective. But you're certainly right. That is, there's more than a number of politicians that make that claim. I think it's a bad thing because the rise of China to that global dominance undermines the sort of central political dispensations of democracies, the idea of freedom of speech, the idea that people can take different views from their governments. It undermines the alliance system on which we've built our security with the United States really for the past 75 years or so. And so it may be true that we can sell the Chinese stuff, but the price we're going to have to pay to do that is to be politically quiescent. And that just doesn't, I think, sit well with how Australia thinks about its place in the world. It may be fine for Cambodia, say, which is largely inside China's orbit inside Southeast Asia. But for a country like Australia, which wants to be able to play its own role in the international community, more often than not, a dominant China is a China that's going to be a problem for us.
So if I can really simplify in a very simplistic way what you just said, those are the choices. We can be an assertive, independent nation, or we can be something akin to Cambodia and essentially just tug our forelocks to the Chinese Communist Party.
It's not a choice that Australia would necessarily want to have. And I think back to an earlier, maybe a simpler time, for example, when John Howard was Prime Minister, one of John's assessments was, we don't have to choose. You know, we can manage a relationship with China and the US at the same time.
That has been the mantra of successive governments. And I'd say it's essentially the mantra of the current government.
I think that's absolutely right. I think our government would say that, in fact, they've rescued that situation for us by stabilizing, as they call it, relations with China. And therefore, we're back in this wonderland where, you know, we can sell China everything we produce. America will underwrite our security. We don't have to spend very much on that at all. My message, and I think it's really one of the sort of underlying themes of the book, which is titled No Higher Priority and is available for sale on Amazon.com.au.
Oh, on Amazon, do you say?
It is, in fact, on Amazon.com. One of the themes of the book is really to say, look, those days are past. You know, we no longer can kind of tiptoe between a China which is making us wealthy but is not very powerful internationally and an America that wants to be the dominant world policeman. In fact, neither of those propositions are true anymore. And so we have to now rethink, I think, how our security is designed.
Yeah, I agree that the world has fundamentally changed. We can talk about Donald Trump later, but I think Trump is accelerating things that were already afoot. The issue for me is that, in a sense, a lot of the government's strategic documents, both this government and the previous one, set out some of these changes and reached the conclusion that we no longer have 10 years of warning time to prepare for the future and that the prospect of great power conflict in our region was actually a real one and we need to be prepared for that. Do you actually see signs of them acting on their own words?
So this is the puzzle. How is it that we can be in a world where there is a Canberra consensus about the changed, more dangerous strategic outlook and yet not be appearing to take any useful steps to strengthen our position in response to that? For me, I think one of the things that kind of crystallised this left and right brain failure of alignment was a speech that the current Defence Minister Richard Marles gave to the Sydney Institute, I think probably in about April or May of 2024, where he said, look, that's not really the strategic cat that I'm trying to skin. Yeah, so, well, sorry for cat lovers out there, but
I hope he's not skinning any cats. But yeah,
I can't imagine he'd do a very good job of it. And but you know, this was to defend a force structure plan, which really delivers a changed, much more capable, beautifully formed little ADF,
exquisitely designed, perfect small ADF that could slot perfectly into a nice spot made for it by the US on some, you know, multinational task force.
That's the one, but not until about 2040, Marcus. And until such time as we get to, you know, the most beautiful sort of Hornby Railway collection of military kit that has ever been assembled, what the current government is doing is actually cutting capability out of the current ADF, which I distinguish from the fantasy force, which is the 2040 ADF. The government has cut in the order of somewhere between $80 and $100 billion of real capability out of the current ADF by, for example, retiring the HMAS Anzac early, by not upgrading the remainder of the Anzac class of frigates, by grounding helicopters so that our army can't do troop lift.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long list of these things. We talk about that in the paper. So stripping out air defence from the investment plan, ballistic missile defence, reducing the number of infantry fighting vehicles. It is a very long and extensive
and
list.
And on.
We can argue about whether that was ever affordable in the first place.
Yeah.
That's a separate issue. Whether it was, it's no longer there.
To the point that I think if Australia was called upon to do, for example, an East Timor stabilisation size of operation, so a large brigade plus type deployment that has to be sustained for a continuing period. I don't know that we could do that right now, Marcus. I think it would actually take us a good deal of time to build up to that level. So here's the bizarre reality, is that faced with this deterioration of our strategic circumstances, we're actually weakening the current ADF, which this government has been resolutely focused on doing for the last 3 years or so, in a way which bears no relationship to the strategic threat that they preface all of their statements about defence with. It's just bizarre.
I mean, I thought we'd turned a corner in 2020 when the previous government put out its defence strategic update and said we no longer have 10 years of warning time. And there's all of these new threats out there. And I thought that was a very clear signal to defence, you've got to act faster. And yet nothing really seems to have changed. Here we are 5 years down the track from that. We're still waiting for long-range strike missiles to show up. We are still looking for some of the reforms to defence's processes to actually result in faster acquisition. And nothing seems to have changed barely in 5 years since that, I thought, crystallising moment.
Crystallising moment. And it was in some respects. But I've heard Scott Morrison talk about that subsequent, after he lost office. And, Morrison has said really two things about, in particular, AUKUS as being the centrepiece of, you know, his national security approach. One was to say, well, of course, more money was going to have to be spent on AUKUS. Problem, Scott Morrison didn't spend any more money. I mean, he simply did not shift the, as you've written about so well, he didn't shift the fundamental policy settings for the defence budget from the 2016 defence white paper. The other thing Morrison has said, he said it on a documentary that Sky ran recently about the submarine capability, was that he wanted AUKUS to be disruptive. He wanted it to change how defence did things, planned for things. But that didn't happen either, because all that Morrison did was really kind of hand this AUKUS gift, if you want to call it that.
It has brought disruption in the sense of being this huge opportunity cost and sucking resources out of the rest of defence and the broader government in Australia.
I'm sure that's not what Scott was thinking. I mean, he wanted things done differently. He wanted policy done faster, more innovatively, more quickly. Yeah. But then he just handed AUKUS to the existing defence system, which treated it in exactly the same way as they've treated every other area of policy, that is to say, glacially, so that we get an outcome, for example, with so-called Pillar 2, all of the tech other than nuclear submarines, which was supposed to be early wins, low-hanging fruit, you know, technological successes that could be harvested between the three countries. And now we have defence saying, oh, Pillar 2 is really going to happen after the delivery of AUKUS submarine. Yeah. In other words, 10, 15 years.
It was meant to be the fast bit.
It was meant to be the fast
bit. To fill the gap until the nuclear submarines showed up.
It's now become the slowest bit after the slow bit of the submarine. So governments have failed, and I wouldn't want listeners to think I'm only going to be nasty about the current government. There have been failings of past coalition governments too. And really from here on, I think whoever wins the next election has got to understand that business as usual equals failure.
Yes. Well, and that sort of gets us to the 800-pound orange gorilla in the corner, so the return of Donald Trump. Now, you probably would recall when the Three Amigos were still in Aspie, we tried to have a bit of a Plan B debate when Donald Trump was in power the first time round, and to say, do we need to fundamentally change a lot of our defence and strategic policy settings in the light of Donald Trump and the reliability of the US alliance? In a sense, in the face of general inertia, that really didn't go anywhere. And in fact, AUKUS is essentially doubling down on the alliance. It's not a plan B. It's essentially saying plan A is great and we're going to go all in even further on plan A. We wrote this book, which is called No Higher Priority.
Available on Amazon.
Available on Amazon. We wrote that before Donald Trump was returned to power, though it was obviously a real possibility as we were writing it. Since his inauguration, I think all of the things you've been talking about have just accelerated. It was probably the most more churn in any two-month period than I can ever remember. How does Donald Trump change anything? Is ANZUS, AUKUS, should that still be plan A, or do we need a different plan, or do we need plan A and plan B? What's your view?
I think my start point would be to say it's too early to close the shop as far as the ANZUS relationship is concerned, and even as far as AUKUS is concerned. And ultimately, I think that there's enough of the a sort of mainstay of American strategic thinking, particularly about the place of the US in the Indo-Pacific, which is going to enable alliance cooperation to continue. But it is going to be very different from where we've been. And I think that we need to be alive to that. I think one of the things our government has failed to do has been to sufficiently anticipate the changed nature of the second Trump administration. It's actually more coherent in the sense of, you know, Trump has got a plan which he is going to implement come what may that's going to change the shape of American administration, America's place in the world, parts of which I agree with. I mean, I'm completely supportive of the proposition that America needs to reduce its overall level of debt. Mm-hmm. I can't see how the world's largest economy can have a debt that's 120% the size of the economy without that becoming catastrophic.
For every dollar the government brings in tax revenue, they spend $1.50.
Yes.
That's how bad it
is. And so, you know, Trump has to do that. And clearly some of the ways that he's going about doing that, draining the swamp, you know, using Musk and the boys at Doge to sort of create havoc inside American public administration, it's not going to be pretty. That's very clear. And the other thing is, you know, Trump is very much, as everyone says, a transactionalist. In other words, what have you done for me lately? He's not going to be impressed by a century of mateship or all of the other sort of forms of language that we've used to talk about our closeness with the Americans without wanting to inject real substance into that cooperation. And so I think the message for Australia is we have got to get serious about defence spending and our own security. But I think at this point, my policy approach would be to say, let's try to sustain the alliance rather than conclude, as some people have. I think Malcolm Turnbull's kind of at this point by saying, well, now we should just walk away from it. I don't agree with that.
Walking away is very challenging. It would leave such huge gaps in our defence capability. So what kind of space surveillance, you know, satellite capability do we have? None.
Yes.
None,
yes.
You know, as an example. So there are all of those kind of deep enablers that we just do not have whatsoever aside from actual combat power. So one of the lines you wrote in this great book, No Higher Priority, was that we are terrible at predicting the future. Mm. The record of Australian strategic policy elites is terrible at predicting the future. And so when people go, oh, what should we do with the alliance? What should we do here and there? It's like, well, you can't pick a particular future because you'll be wrong. All you can do is, whether you're future casting, whether you're doing SWOT analysis, whatever tool you're using to look at the future, you kind of have to have courses of action that can address multiple futures. Yes. And so if you think the alliance is still reliable, well, guess what? The price of participation, as Trump and his leaders are telling the rest of the world, it's gone from 2% to 3% or even 4%.
Yes.
So if you want to rely on the US, you've got to pay at least for 3%. My own view is that's perfectly reasonable. If we are relying on them and they're spending 3.5% of GDP and Mr. and Mrs. Person in the street in Ohio are paying 3.5% to protect us, it's only reasonable that we should be paying a similar amount.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, you think the US is unreliable and we're going to be on our own and we need more resilience and self-reliance, it's at least 3%. So whichever way you look at it, unless you are going to retreat into some kind of partially armed neutrality in the South Pacific and hope the world just ignores you and passes you by, the answer is now at least 3%.
Yes. Well, and I think the truth would be that in a world where we can no longer rely on the alliance relationship, we probably can't buy defence capability at any price that's going to measure what we can get from the alliance relationship. So we could be 6%. We can try and turn ourselves into Sweden. But even Sweden, at the end of the day, concluded that being in NATO was a better deal for them with all of the efforts that they've made for, you know, greater self-reliance.
Unfortunately, we don't have the NATO option.
Yeah. Exactly.
We do not. I mean, Belgium can look around and go, 5 of the 10 biggest GDPs in the world are part of NATO, even if the US leaves.
Yes.
We don't. We've got New Zealand,
yes.
Which, as much as I like New Zealand.
Well, we have some other options. Japan, I think, is an option. And, you know, you did say, would we have written anything differently in the book had it been written post the Trump ascendancy as opposed to beforehand? One of the recommendations the book makes is that we should now try and bring Japan into the ANZUS alliance relationship, which I am still very much in favour of. I think if it turned out that Trump was too unreliable for us to assume we can continue defence cooperation, we should be now looking to Japan as a defence partner with the treaty, because I think our strategic interests coincide very closely and sufficiently for us to get closer to Tokyo. So I still think that we need to be thinking of Australian security in collective security terms. It's the democracies working mm-hmm. together. Of course, it's a huge challenge in that world where the US is the unreliable partner. But as I say, I don't think we can conclude that that's in fact where Trump is going. Trump could make America stronger. He will want allies to be stronger. Okay, I'm up with that. And the good news is that being a stronger and more effective ally with the United States is going to make us a stronger independent player mm-hmm. anyway.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of assumptions there, Marcus, like, will the Americans continue to sell us fifth generation combat aircraft, for example? I think they will, but by golly, if that's a problem.
I've described myself as an AUKUS agnostic. So I'm not anti AUKUS, SSNs, or pro. I think we need to understand the risks, and that's both sides of politics are at the moment committed to it. So there's no point, you know, saying get out of it. Yes. I think we need to just lay out the issues there. My own view is those risks have increased since Donald Trump returned to power. So it is where the barometer or the needle, I think, is heading in the wrong direction. But again, early days. But so now we're starting to talk about recommendations. One of the key recommendations is get to 3% of GDP as soon as possible. And we sketch out a trajectory for that. It's none of this, well, we'll get to 2 in a bit sometime in the 2030s. It is a very, I would say, pretty racy schedule, which of course raises those questions of, how are you going to spend it? Well, we sketch out some things to spend it on. One of yours and my favorite recommendations is the B-21, a long-range strike option. In a sense, a plan B for SSNs that is valuable whether or not SSNs ever arrive. Relatively affordable compared to SSNs. But of course, it's an American system. So it does involve doubling down again on the US. So how do you feel about that recommendation? Do you stand by that one now?
I do. And look, Trump likes to sell aircraft. And again,
that is one of the things he said about Australia that was a good thing. We buy lots of American aircraft.
And I do think, people misread Trump, and in a lot of cases, they let sort of a dislike of his politics colour an attempt to really understand what's going on. I don't see Trump as an isolationist. I see Trump as an America first, strong United States position. Trump is clearly going to involve the United States in parts of the world where they think their security interests are need to be underpinned by American power. And that's who he is. I think Trump has an instinct to find weakness amongst America's partners. It's why he hammers NATO so much. And I am absolutely convinced that, you know, when the moment comes that Trump looks at AUKUS, he will conclude that the Australian government has not been serious enough in its attempts to make it work. Indeed, I think Anthony Albanese has thought that AUKUS was this cool trick where he could talk big about security, but, you know, the real delivery of it was going to be 10 or 15 years down the track. So we don't have a start. We don't even have a location on the so-called Navy port on the East Coast. We don't have a start on thinking about how we're going to manage nuclear waste storage, which is essential in terms of our treaty obligations with the IAEA if we're going to have nuclear submarines. And I think we have in the order of, you know, 10, perhaps 20 Navy people in training at the moment, which is fantastic for them. But none of that looks to me like a serious start on making AUKUS happen. The Americans have moved further and faster than we have, getting their own sort of administrative systems arranged to support the three countries working together. And we've been free riding in ways that Trump will not tolerate.
And AUKUS, in a sense, is a subset of that broader free riding.
Yes.
Of 2-ish% is kind of been the target for so long.
It mystifies me beyond words, although I shall now try to use words, to sort of say how it is that both sides of politics have not sort of dived in the direction of making bigger commitments. Given the broader context of government spending, which is we're adding a percentage of GDP every year to the government spend for no real value, it seems to me, but not in defence. Now, one of the arguments is, well, defence is such a shambolic organisation right now when it comes to equipment procurement that they've got to get their act together first. Yeah, but government plays a role in that. It's not just the department.
And you've got to fix the plane while you're flying it.
Yes.
In this regard. If we wait for defence to achieve perfection in project development and project delivery, it's never going to happen, you know. So,
well, it'll happen on sort of AUKUS Pillar 2 time frames, which means it's never going to happen, Marcus. Yep. So we've got to get better.
So we do talk about some big ticket items like B-21, but we also have a number of recommendations about supporting Australian industry. That is, I think, at the core of this work called No Higher Priority, where we really push for greater support for Australian defence industry, for the great companies that are out there already producing the consumables of war, things such as munitions, both smart and dumb, drones, both, you know, in the air, underwater, all of these things that Australian industry can do already. So what have we recommended there in terms of getting stuff done quickly?
Look, I think the essence of it is that we've got to see contracts flowing to Australian business. And that means to say that we have to break defence of its fixation that it can only do business with the primes. I love the primes like brothers and sisters, but we have to start seeing money flow towards Australian SMEs, because they are going to be the innovators. They are going to be the producers of a whole range of equipment that we will need to have in large quantities that's replaceable, that we cannot rely on international supply chains to deliver. So the core recommendation is, let's now ensure that in the defence budget a significant volume of money is allocated towards Australian SMEs.
Yeah, and I think, again, if we are doing our future casting and looking at alternative futures, I think one thing that is common to all conceivable futures is the growth of autonomous systems, is the growth of the small, the smart and the many, and the need to be able to produce that domestically in times of crisis. So to me, it's a no-brainer, whether you're a fan of the alliance or not, whether you're a fan of AUKUS or not, it's something we need to be doing.
There's one recommendation I'd like to just quickly mention, because I know we're probably up against the time limit, but I think it's one that our listeners will enjoy, and that is that we've said there needs to be a cut of about a third in defence star rank officers and public service senior executive service officers, and that third cut should take place within a single term of government. Now, why do we say that? Well, it's because from 2003 to 2023, over a 20-year period, there's been a doubling of a number of generals in the ADF, and there's been a mere 80% growth in the number of SES inside the Defence Public Service. And yet what it has done is produce an organisation which is, you know, deeply constipated in terms of its inability to produce sensible lateral thinking and decisions. I have not met a senior military officer, either still serving or recently retired, who does not agree with the proposition mm-hmm. that we need to reduce the numbers of senior military officers and public service SES. And I think that's a relatively easy one for a new government or a returned Labor government to do. They simply say to the department, make that cut by a third in the first term or in the next 3 years of government. That's not going to make a huge amount of savings, but I think it could be the first important step to cultural reform inside defence.
I think it's a huge step towards cultural reform, you know, not just to sort of break down stovepipes, but to increase accountability. So, I mean, every time we listen to Senate estimates hearings, senators ask a question about submarines. It's always the case that whoever's sitting at the table goes, well, sorry, I don't cover that bit of submarines. Submarine infrastructure. And sorry, that's handled by another DEPSEC.
Yes.
And it's like, but that DEPSEC's gone home, so we can't answer that question. Or I don't handle that particular bit of submarines. You know, that's a people problem, and that's handled by the people. And I just think it's terrible for accountability, because nobody owns a single whole problem.
A question to ask is, how did it get that way, considering that it's not many years since we had the first principles review, the strong centre that it was supposed to create for fast decision making inside the department? And yet it seems that whenever defence is confronted with a challenging policy problem, the answer has been, let's create more three stars and more deputy secretaries to answer the problem. And it's not working.
That is actually what happened. And in fact, the previous Chief of the Defence Force at Estimates gave that answer. He said, well, we deal with a whole bunch of really complex stuff, and so that's why we need a three star for each complex problem, because apparently two stars and one stars aren't smart enough to deal with complexity, is my reading of that answer.
And one of the things that's led to is we now have, on some people's counting, seven separate procurement entities inside the defence organisation, when really there's not the skill base to hold more than one.
Mm.
And so I think that there is some important reform which should give governments more confidence that the money they spend on defence is going to be better allocated. In keeping with your principle that we've got to repair the aircraft while we're flying it, that has to happen at the same time as spending is increased to enable an expansion of a more capable defence force to deal with the current strategic threats rather than the fantasy force of 2040.
Yeah, and I will point out to people who have suggested somewhat unkindly that, well, you guys would suggest more money because you come from defence, and what really needs to happen is reform inside defence and greater accountability. And I'll just say, well, read the book, because we do cover reform inside defence and ways to get greater accountability out of defence. That is part and parcel of the recommendations in this great book called No Higher Priority.
Available on amazon.com.au.
All right. Well, I'll thank our listeners for their indulgence in listening to us. Thank you, Peter, for your first appearance as a grumpy strategist. I will say that I've never found you to be very grumpy. You know, I've worked for you. I've worked with you. You've always been a complete gentleman, and you need to work on your inner grump just a bit.
I'm the happy strategist, Marcus, but it's great fun being in the grumpy grotto. So thanks for having me.
Thank you.